You are listening to the Cycling Podcast.
Hello, and joining you after a weekend when a 40-year-old English lawyer showed those chumps in the World Tour exactly how to beat Tadej Pogacar, I gratefully accept a 5-minute head start for a 14-kilometer charity hill climb the morning after Lombardy. My name's Daniel Freiber. I am the host of this episode of the Cycling Podcast, in which we will, yes, review the unsuccessful giant-killing attempts on Saturday, and perhaps also ponder how and if the Slovalian might get yanked back to Earth in 2026. Joining me to do that today, his head is not on Mars, but in Mallorca, like the rest of his anatomy, I think, it is Roberto Hatch.
Hola.
And joining us from his space station in not Watford is Cycling Podcast's own extraterrestrial, who's calming, cooling down. We've had a heated debate already. Before we started recording today about guess what is Tadej Pogacar's domination boring or not? That might be continued later.
Hang on a minute. Misrepresentation already. The word boring was not used.
This sport's got a problem. Are the exact words?
Well, it's got several problems, but look, we'll get into it a bit later. But I think reducing this to a sort of binary discussion about what is boring and what is entertaining, as you said, Daniel, kind of overlooks the fact that different people watch cycling for different reasons. They're looking for different things, or indeed sport. Sport speaks to people in so many different ways.
The cheesecake of engagement might get taken back out of the fridge after a long absence from the Cycling Podcast in this episode.
Gents, do I have to put my referee's outfit on today? Because this has started well, hasn't it?
Feisty.
I was getting quite annoyed at the weekend, reading some of the talk about it being incredibly tedious. Anyway, chaps, maybe...
Where was this talk about it being incredibly tedious?
Unfortunately, it was on social media, mate.
Well, corners of the internet, all the greatest thinkers lie.
Yeah, and I'm probably now being fed, my algorithm is conspiring to feed me all of this stuff that it knows is going to get under my skin now. So anyway, what about that though, chaps? The Slovalian, that's not bad, is it?
Eh? Oh, you got me there.
With the search, the quest for a decent nickname, at least, goes on. But chaps, otherwise, all okay?
Yeah, very well, thank you. Very well. End of the season. Mbappé.
Not quite. They're still racing in China, still racing in the Netherlands. I mean, the Tour of Holland has crept up on me. I had no idea that the Tour of Holland was on this week. One to keep an eye on, isn't it?
Brand new race, isn't it? There used to be a Tour of Holland that used to take place after the Tour de France, but that sort of disappeared, got absorbed into the Eneco Renewi Tour. And as you say, Lionel, this week we have got the Tour of the Netherlands. I had a quick look at the stage profiles earlier. Lionel, if this sport does have a problem, I would suggest that as far as I'm concerned, it's stage races with, I think it's five stages, with a combined elevation, combined altitude gain of about 50 meters. Anyway, chaps, time for the newsette. Lots to catch up on. As always, we're going to select a story each, a theme, and we are going to meditate on that for a moment. Lionel, would you like to go first?
Well, I will, Daniel. Yeah, this is the situation regarding Derek G, the Canadian rider who was fourth in the Giro d'Italia this season for Israel Premier Tech. Now, he notified the team before the Vuelta of his intention to leave, breaking his contract. He had a multi-year contract that he signed in 2023, which I think took him up to 2028 with the Israel Premier Tech team. Lots going on with that team, of course, in light of the protests which disrupted the Vuelta a España. The owner of the Factor bike company, which supplies the team with bikes, has insisted on a name change and a flag change. The team has now agreed to a name change, and the boss, Sylvain Adams, who really has been the driving force behind the team since it began, the Cycling Academy, really elevating the profile of cycling in Israel, not least by getting the Grande Partenza of the 2018 Giro d'Italia to start in Israel. A very memorable weekend that was too. Done an awful lot to give a pathway for Israeli riders to make their way into the sport at a World Tour level as well. But Sylvain Adams is going to step back. No confirmation yet on what the name change will be or what sort of cosmetic changes this will mean for the team. But Derek G, clearly their hottest property, a Grand Tour rider, ninth in the Tour de France last year, fourth in the Giro, as I say. Ineos had been rumoured to be interested in taking the Canadian rider, but I'm sure there would be other suitors as well. And when he left the team, he said, "I terminated my contract with Just Cause, as is every person's right, when they're unable to continue performing their work under the existing circumstances. The decision was not taken lightly. It followed an irreparable relationship with the team principal, as well as serious concerns related to racing for the team, both from a safety and personal belief standpoint that weighed heavily on my conscience." He's since said that he's now facing what he understands to be a damages claim exceeding 30 million euros. And he says, "For doing nothing more than exercising my fundamental rights as a professional and a person." Now, as we know, a contract is a contract. There has to be some kind of breach on one side or the other for one party to get out. So there will have to be some kind of negotiation here. The UCI is going to arbitrate on this. But this is a sort of labyrinthine, quite messy issue, because the name change for the Israel Premier Tech team is really going without precedent, isn't it? Unlike Russia, Israel is not barred from international sport. There's been no ban from any sporting federation, such as the International Olympic Committee or equivalent governing bodies like FIFA and UEFA in football. The UCI has no rule barring Israeli properties, teams, individuals, athletes, sponsors from taking part in cycling. And yet, because of the protests and also the feeling within the team from riders and staff, I guess, there has been an agreement that the Israel name will be not featuring on the team's name next season. So whether any of those changes weaken Derek G's bid to get himself out of his contract, I don't know.
Just in terms of chronology, Lionel, as well, worth bearing in mind that Derek G's termination, sort of unilateral termination, predates everything that happened at the Vuelta. And then also in terms of chronology, obviously in the last 24 hours, we've had a peace deal that has been brokered in the Middle East. So presumably some of the grounds, I mean, he talked about personal belief, personal beliefs and his own safety in the statement. Some of those may have evaporated.
Absolutely, yeah. And I think also, I mean, the UCI's complete absence of leadership on this issue, I mean, it really stands out, I think. They're going to arbitrate on a contractual basis here, I guess. But the UCI awarded the licenses to teams that ride with the names of states on their jerseys. Israel's not the only one. There's also UAE and Bahrain, victorious. And I mean, there are subtle differences between, you know, who's actually paying the money. I mean, the Israel Premier Tech team is not a property of Israel, the country. It's more of a branding exercise that comes from Sylvain Adams' desire to promote Israel. And I do think that this situation of Israel having to take the name off the jersey, the team having to take the name off the jersey, and there's even been suggestions of registering not as an Israeli team, I think this sets a really uncomfortable precedent for the UCI and the sport as a whole. Without wanting to divert into even more political waters, the UAE is alleged to be involved in funding and arming the rapid support forces in the Sudanese civil war. That's been going on since 2023. There's allegations of ethnic cleansing and genocide in that conflict. And the UAE, although they deny supplying the arms and weapons, there is a lot of reports and a lot of kind of evidence that suggests that the UAE has a role, is playing a role in that conflict. And, you know, if we're going to have, you know, a rule applied to one team in a sport like cycling, you know, geopolitics can't just kind of arbitrarily decide, well, you know, sorry, Israel, no. But when a similar-ish situation arises concerning another team sponsor and another team's identity, well, we're going to look the other way there. So the UCI really has to show some kind of leadership when not just arbitrating with Derek G's situation, which is you know, may well just boil down to a contractual dispute. But the sport itself has kind of created the circumstances that have led to what could end up being quite a hypocritical situation here. And I think this is one that the sport needs to get a grip of.
Lionel, just in case people are wondering, what is this UCI? What was the word they used? Arbitral, I think they used, board or arbitration board, and whether they've ruled on any cases before. There was a somewhat analogous case in the sense that one rider wanted to break his contract a few years ago, and that was Andre Amador, who was at Movistar, and he wanted to move to Ineos, and the same panel was called to rule on that. However, midway through that process, the two teams finally did find an agreement. I believe a fee was paid and Amador did leave and go to Ineos.
Can I as well just say, gents, that I guess that waters could be further muddied in all of this in terms of finding a resolution, depending on the employment and contract law where the contract signed as well. I think that's something that often happens in cycling, because we talk about, you know, even social security payments, for example, just a random example that certain teams in France have to make concerned with and compared with teams based in Switzerland or the UK, where the rates are completely different. So there's a lot of mazes and turns in the contractual maze, I guess, to try and find a way out there.
Yeah, I mean, all of the parties could come to an agreement, couldn't they? I mean, the Juan Ayuso case, where he was under contract with UAE Team Emirates and moved to Lidl Trek, with kind of unconfirmed reports of quite a hefty transfer fee having been paid by Lidl Trek to get him out of his UAE contract. I mean, it all could be resolved by all parties getting around the table, whichever team it is that Derek G intends to go to, and thrashing out an agreement. But the fact that the UCI is at this stage going to arbitrate suggests that, well, I mean, 30 million euros as damages for what we currently know as the Israel Premier Tech team. I mean, it's a lot of money. I mean, it will far exceed probably the contract, or maybe it doesn't far exceed the contract over 5-6 years. I mean, it would far exceed the contract, you would think, over 5-6 years. But of course, they're losing an asset. They're losing a rider with proven results. So we'll see how that plays out. Obviously, the clock's ticking, because the new season won't be that far away.
Clock ticking, Lionel, as well. Now we get to my item, the relegation struggle. Now we're going to do a bit of a deep dive when all is sort of, when the dust has settled in a couple of weeks' time, and we know who has effectively been relegated from the World Tour, who is going to rely on wildcard places in World Tour races next year. But as we know, as we've been talking about for a while now, there is a battle going on. We think the main battle is between Uno X and Cofidis for a World Tour place for the next 3 years. Now, I'm not going to give you the up-to-date, the absolute up-to-the-minute scores, because they're changing by the day with races still going on. But Uno X are currently in position to get the last World Tour spot. That is presuming that this long-mooted merger between Intermarché and Lotto goes ahead. Still no confirmation of that, but we still do believe that he's going to go ahead. And yes, Cofidis are still trying to hunt down Uno X. Now, few races still to go. Cofidis are still in action in Guangxi, which is a World Tour race. Obviously, a lot of points available there. The Veneto races, that's Pippo Pozzato's races in Italy, and I think the Japan Cup. Uno X have only got the Veneto races still available to score points, but as I say, they're in the box seat at the moment. But keep your eye, you know where to look. I think the results website's where to look. Keep your eye on those rankings over the next few days. That's the 2023 to 2025 rankings. Now, there are other battles also going ahead, because the rules on wild cards are changing next year. And for 2026, from 2026, the three best UCI Pro teams from the previous year. Now, this is a different set of rankings. This is only this year's rankings. The three best pro teams will automatically receive invitations to all UCI World Tour events, including the Grand Tours. There are going to be 23 teams in the Grand Tour, so there'll be those three best pro teams plus two other wild cards. Now, Coffees are also trying to hang on. They're sort of struggling to hang on this ranking, so the ranking just for this year, because at present it looks as though those three best pro teams for this year are going to be Tudor, Q36.5, and Cofidis. But trying to chase down Cofidis on that ranking are TotalEnergies. TotalEnergies, even if they don't manage to overhaul Cofidis, they could still get one of two last wild cards for the Tour de France. We also have to think about the Vuelta a España. We talked about this a couple of weeks ago. And of course, the Giro, Vuelta a España, Cofidis's position, even if they were to miss out, would probably look slightly rosy because they're a sponsor of that race. But also to bear in mind is the fact that teams, in order to even qualify for the sort of subjective wildcards, the last two wildcard spots, they have to be in the top 30 of this year's rankings. Now, this affects two Italian teams, Bardiani and Solution Tech Vinifantini. Bardiani are currently in 30th place, Solution Tech are in 31st place, but there's a battle going on that score as well. Races going on, there's a race in Japan at the moment, Tour of Kyushu, where Solution Tech are trying to score points to make themselves eligible for one of those last two spots, for example, for the Giro d'Italia. So you need eyes everywhere in this last week of the season. Also, there's the Tour of Holland, Netherlands, the Chrono des Nations, where TotalEnergies are trying to hunt for points as well. So all sorts going on.
All sorts going on, and all sorts that I might be a bit of a party pooper here, because all sorts that could go on in the courts and at the UCI again, sorry to name them once more, because you quite rightly mentioned about Andermatt and Lotto. Andermatt currently occupy that last World Tour spot in the rankings. There isn't actually in the UCI rules an obligation to have an 18-team World Tour. So the UCI could also decide that for the next 3 years, and I'm not sure why they do this, but this is the UCI, so you never know, they could also decide to have a 17-team World Tour. Anything between 16 and 18 teams is the rule that they stipulated themselves. So it could be a case where UnoX, who are, by the way, currently just under 400 points ahead of Cofidis, could get that, as you quite rightly said, Daniel, but they might find themselves having to ask very nicely through the courts to try and get in. In terms of, you mentioned that top 30 ranking, just something that springs to my head, Euskaltel, they're going to be one of the names that are really going to miss out, because there's no chance for them to get in the Vuelta a España next year. And obviously, the further down that ranking you get, the more of those big races where you can score points you're going to miss out on. So it's going to be very difficult for them next year. We'll have to see where they go.
I mean, talk about absurdity, the absurdity of how professional cycling is structured and organised here. I mean, we've got two different rankings that relate to two different things. You've got the three-year ranking, which relates to World Tour places, and then the one-year ranking, which applies to eligibility for wild cards for the major races. I mean, it's as clear as mud, this system, really. And I don't want to just sort of... Well, it is the UCI's responsibility to have a coherent system. There's livelihoods, there's riders' contracts, there's staff members, there's teams' futures hinging on these rankings. And it is not easy to find out without kind of... I mean, if you go on the UCI's website, you cannot readily and easily find these results. It's far easier to find the results and the rankings on external websites, such as Pro Cycling Stats, which is the one that I'm looking at. And really, some of these stories should be highlighted. I mean, XDS Astana, we talked about it a lot at the start of the year about how they were going to have this strategy to hoover up points by trying to, you know, value sort of third, fourth and fifth in a one-day race over perhaps the one shot at winning a race. They were going to target points. They've certainly targeted smaller races over the last months of the season, haven't they, to try and get points. I mean, to use a football analogy, they really, Alexander Vinokourov is the Sam Allardyce of cycling. He has dragged them clear of the relegation zone, and on the one-year ranking, they are the fourth best team of the season. UAE Team Emirates are way clear, as you'd expect, then Visma Elisabike, then Lidl Trek, but XDS Astana, the fourth best team of the season. And I think that the UCI really ought to sort of simplify this whole thing and find a way to generate. There's a narrative here that is interesting at top and bottom, but it's quite hard to sort of tell that story coherently, especially when they're not in real time.
Yeah, and some of the teams aren't even racing against each other. You know, they've decided, you know, one team has decided to go to a stage race in Japan, the other team is at the Cornwall de Nation. And it also strikes me, chaps, that this system could be vulnerable to abuse. Imagine a scenario where there's a rider who knows who's currently riding for Solution Tech and he knows he's going to Badiani next year. And, you know, we've talked about spot betting in cycling. It doesn't really matter on a flat stage if you're 31st rather than 52nd, but it could matter if, you know, you've got money on the outcome of that particular matchup. And the same applies here. Just also, finally on this, chaps, I just wanted to give credit to, I think he's an English gentleman called Joseph Whiteley, at Joe Whiteley, that's LEY0711 on Twitter. His Twitter account is the best place to glean up-to-date sort of points totals and up-to-date information on how this relegation battle is going. He's keeping a very close eye on it.
What we need is some kind of relegation beef, don't we? Like Sir Alex Ferguson and Kevin Keegan. I mean, we're talking 30 years ago in the English Premier League, but you can just imagine somebody, they've got to go to Guangxi and get something. They've got to go to Holland and get something. I would love it if we beat them.
Gents, I mean, I think we talked about this at the start of the season. I'm all for it. I think the team bosses are against it, and sort of understandably so. A lot of them don't come from European sports where there is that jeopardy. There's a couple of the American managers who, you know, they come from, they're used to watching franchise sports and they'd like a franchise system. For me, that doesn't do anything from a getting involved and a bit of a jeopardy point of view. I completely understand the economic arguments of it, but I think that it could be a whole new layer of interest for people if it becomes clearer. However, having that, I don't think you could have a three-year system. It needs to be yearly, doesn't it? It needs to be something that's easily understandable as well. Well, my story, gents, I'm afraid, comes from a much sadder place. I took a phone call towards the end of last week from a colleague of mine who worked at Eurosport in France. And that phone call was to tell me about the very sad, untimely death of a colleague of ours. Guillaume Di Grazia, the age of 52, died after an accident at a bull running festival last week in his native France. Guillaume was a colleague of mine and everybody at Eurosport for a long, long time. Best part of three decades he spent there, actually. He was very keen on winter sports. He was the voice of cycling in France for a long, long time as well on Eurosport. And he was a very passionate colleague to be around from the south of France, one that I know got on with a lot of riders, a lot of teams, did a lot to try and bring new sports, new shows. I know he had a weekly chat show, Bistro Vélo, that he started on Eurosport as well. And Guillaume will be very sadly missed by his colleagues, Jackie, Steve, Louis-Pierre and everybody else at Eurosport France. And I'd like to send out my condolences to his family and friends and the rest of his colleagues. Guillaume Di Grazia, who died last week at the age of 52.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton. Cycling podcast team car at the back of the pack, please.
That's Seb Piquet, the voice of Radio Tour, to remind me to tell you that this episode is sponsored by NordVPN. Now, you all know what a VPN is by now, a virtual private network. They've never been more popular, and NordVPN is my personal choice, has been since long before they started advertising in the cycling podcast, actually. And because you're a cycling podcast listener, you can get a great deal at nordvpn.com/TCP. If you use that link, you'll get 4 months extra for free when you buy a 2-year plan. So that's nordvpn.com/TCP. Now, there are lots of advantages to having a VPN, and the primary one is internet security, keeping all of your private information safe and secure. Critical data like your bank account details, passwords and logins, and your online identity will all be protected when you've got NordVPN switched on. One NordVPN account can be used on up to 10 different devices, so you can protect yourself whenever and wherever you're online, whether it's with your computer or laptop, a phone or tablet on the move, or even your smart TV, or in our case, you can hook up your internet router and protect all of the connections in one go with NordVPN. It's premium cybersecurity for the price of a cup of coffee a month. And it's the fastest VPN in the world too. So there's no buffering or lagging when you're streaming your favorite sports events or TV shows. The other advantage is that you can switch your location virtually, which can allow you to save a bit of money when you're buying things like flights or hotel rooms or holidays. There's also NordVPN's threat protection, which protects you from viruses, malicious malware, and phishing sites. And as I say, you can use one account on up to 10 devices to protect you, whether you're online at home or on the move, and especially comes into its own when you're using public Wi-Fi or the Wi-Fi connection in hotel rooms, that kind of thing. So go to nordvpn.com/TCP.
Dawn and dusk and monotonous too, always the same, shade or two different, but always the same. Yet each time feels like the first and the spectacle never gets old. Giotto's frescoes are monotonous, 7 centuries unchanged, yet they dazzle you every time like it's the first. Monotony comes in flavours. There's grey, mediocre, bottom shelf monotony, and there's the indescribable monotony of the extraordinary. Not my words, chaps, but the words of a colleague, Cristiano Gatti, Italian journalist, who... well, I agreed with after the umpteenth Pogster class, Tadej Pogacar masterclass at the weekend. I don't know whether, should we give some statistics as well? Because I think we've established now that adjectives are redundant. So, first rider in history to win the Giro di Lombardia in Lombardia in the rainbow jersey on two occasions, 2024-2025. First rider to win the Tour de France and the Giro di Lombardia in the same season three times, 2021, 2024, 2025. First rider to win Liège and Lombardy in the same year on three occasions, 2021, 2024, 2025. I got millions of these guys.
I mean, you're millions. You're making this domination sound boring, Daniel. I mean, the big headlines man to win the Giro di Lombardia five times, first five time in a row winner, eclipsing the great Fausto Coppi. I think the most impressive statistic of the whole season is that Tadej Pogacar is the first man to finish on the podium of all five one-day monuments in the same season. Third at Milan-San Remo, he won Flanders, second at Paris-Roubaix, he won Liège-Bastogne-Liège, and obviously won Lombardy, and add to that the World Championship road race for good measure. An extraordinary run of results, which, I mean, it's a kind of a redundant debate to suggest whether it eclipses Eddie Merckx, but I think adding all of that lot to the Tour de France title makes it one of the, if not the greatest season by a male rider ever. I think it has to be. I can't think of even an Eddie Merckx season, you know, maybe winning two Grand Tours and a handful of top classic results.
Well, let's get this comparison out of the way straight away. How does it measure up to Pogacar's 2024? The main difference being that he won the Giro d'Italia in 2024. That's the main difference. And obviously he didn't ride Roubaix in 2024. I would say that's the most significant difference. And obviously in Roubaix, we all remember what happened. A crash could possibly have cost him victory there this year on his debut appearance in that race, and he eventually finished second.
Yeah,
and didn't win Flanders last year either.
No, swapping Strade Bianche for Flanders. I think this year eclipses it, yeah, to be honest. I think, and also doing it a second year in a row automatically sort of, you know, adds to it as well. You know, not a one-off season. I mean, I'm not saying that you could dismiss last year as kind of a flash in the pan. Of course you couldn't. But I think the fact that this is a repeat, and I just think being on the podium of all five monuments, I mean, these races, to a degree, it's an arbitrary selection of the five biggest, toughest, most prestigious one-day races, but with good reason. And you know, he's an ace away from completing the set of all five. I mean, when we were talking about his performance at the European Road Race Championships last week with Seb Piquet. Seb, off the mic, said, you know, I think we're kind of all rooting for Pogacar to complete that set and win Milan-San Remo and win Paris-Roubaix and join that really elite club of just three riders who have won all five monuments. I think now, you know, Pogacar, the improvements to his palmarès that he can make are so sort of small now. He has to look at the gaps and really, I think, focus on completing cycling rather than repeating. And when it got all a bit heated earlier, Rob, you pointed out that, you know, winning Lombardia for 5 years in a row and being better than Fausto Coppi is in its way, yes, it's repeating, but it's also completing. We're in uncharted territory. It's an extraordinary run of results. And, everyone else is in the rearview mirror at the moment. And I think the fact that Remco Evenepoel has been second to him three weekends running as well, in a way, just kind of underlines and highlights how far ahead of everybody else he's standing. It's not like he's beating a different cast of characters. He's beating arguably the second best one day rider in the world, sort of handsomely at the moment.
The guy who's won Liège a couple of times when he hasn't been there in the last couple of years as well. It's funny, you talk about repetition. I think I've got a diploma in repetition these last couple of years, and I feel sorry for the viewers who've had to have the extra diploma in listening to me repeat the repetition each and every week. What more is there to say? And I think I've probably run out quicker than most of things to say in the last couple of years when it regards to Pogacar. I mean, he was a precocious talent, wasn't he? When he came on the scene, you know, we all saw what happened earlier on. When he was beaten by Vingegaard in those two tours, he obviously changed his coach, changed his style. We've seen this sort of new seated style, the work in the gym, the different training methods, which I know that you guys did a fantastic couple of episodes on about 18 months ago, I think, before the Giro, when you're in Sierra Nevada and you're talking to his coaches and things like that. And he's sort of become a bit of a Terminator since then, hasn't he? You know, everything is his. You talk about filling in the gaps, Lionel. What is it? This year, he won another new stage race. That was the Dauphiné. He hadn't won that before. Three stage races entered. Three stage races won. Up to four tours now. Three Monument Classic victories. As you say, he was so close to that Roubaix one. That was the big question, wasn't it? At the start of the year, you know. But can he? You know, is it not one step too far? And I think although he didn't win it, he proved that it wasn't. You know, he can compete for that race, and that's going to be an interesting thing to watch in the next few years. We were talking about promotion and relegation and league tables earlier on and the number of points. This year, Pogacar, in his 50 days of competition, amassed 11,680 UCI points. Obviously, that's just a number to most of us, and that goes back to your point, Lionel, about needing for a bit of reform in this system and, you know, having it make sense for us all. But what does it mean? It means that he has more points than 10 of the 18 World Tour teams on his own. And those points totals are amassed by a collection of as many as 20 riders in each team. 20 riders' points count towards those totals. Pog, on his own, he'd almost be in the UEFA Cup by now. It's a tremendous achievement. And of course, that's nothing that's going to be talked about, because we are repeating ourselves each and every week, and we have talked about these almost never-ending, you know, this week he's going to achieve this, this next week he's going to achieve that. And I should know, I have the list of stats in front of me before every race of what he's going to do this week sort of thing. I mean, he is the world's number one cyclist, and yeah, he's every week that goes by, he's closest to being the world's number one cyclist ever, isn't he?
Well... Lionel, you got something to say before?
No, I was just going to say it's his appetite as well, isn't it? I mean, I did sense in that final week of the Tour de France, he was looking a bit weary. You know, I mean, Eddy Merckx nicknamed the cannibal because he devoured the opposition. He would never turn down the opportunity to win. And I just sensed at the end of the Tour de France, having kind of raced so hard in that first 10 days, he turned down a few opportunities.
Have you seen the quotes? Have you seen the quotes from Ciro in the last 24 hours or 48 hours? And not Ciro speaking to Pog, I believe, at the event where he was beaten on Sunday, beaten by an English amateur lawyer. That he's now talked about how he was suffering from knee pain After the Ventoux stage, and this explains why we saw a less voracious Pogacar, less cannibalistic Pogacar in the last half of the Tour de France, so much so that at one stage, in fact the day after the Ventoux stage, he was even contemplating pulling out of the race. What do you make of that, chaps?
Wow. I mean, it may very well be true. I have no reason to doubt Tadej Pogacar.
It wouldn't shock me. Certainly, we've spoken so much this year about these seated accelerations, and this is apparently something that's been introduced or been encouraged by his coach, Javier Solá, who, of course, became his new coach last year. Now, I think it was at the Dauphiné. I asked Pogacar about this because there was a lot of talk about it at the time, and he said no, he hadn't changed anything. But I think subsequently, Javier Solá has talked about it. Other people have talked about it, and I think now Pogacar himself has talked about the fact that this is a thing. This is something he's concentrating on. It's also something that Isaac Del Toro has tried to mimic. But certainly, in my limited experience, chaps, on the bike, when you do maybe push slightly bigger gears in the saddle, this is something that you can suffer from, knee problems.
No big seated accelerations from you next week at our training camp then, just to spoil your ultra run in the winter.
I'm not going to talk about that. I'm not going to talk about the Sakhalov challenge. But, Charles, you know, maybe this sort of leads us dangerously towards the boredom, the boring discussion. But in terms of sort of repetition, Rob, you talked about how it falls to you pretty much every week to describe the same thing. I would sort of put it to you that there are, every single week, there are new talking points. And one of the key talking points, the key jeopardy, comes from this question of how, to what extent can he repeat what he did the previous week? Because we all know the sort of background music, whenever there's domination in a sport, is increasing pressure. And Lionel, you know, you talked about the sort of weariness at the Tour de France, and we all sort of imagine that that was something to do with the increasing pressure, that the sort of burden of history, of your own history, of having to repeat yourself, show that you're not diminishing or that you're not more vulnerable, that other people aren't catching up. And at the weekend, one of the things that caught people's eye, and maybe we'll talk in a minute about just the way the race was ridden, which sort of mimicked as well the way the Worlds was ridden. We've talked in the last few weeks about how the first few hours of these races now are very intense. But anyway, in the sort of Pog's modus operandi and the attack on the Paso de Llanda, which took him away from Evenepoel, and he opened up a pretty big gap pretty quickly. The statistics afterwards, now, he had ridden this route three times in Lombardy, 2021, 2023, 2025. He'd won on each occasion. 2021, 23 minutes, 13 seconds on the Paso de Llanda, about 10 seconds or 8 seconds faster than that in 2023. In 2025, almost 2 minutes faster than 2021. So materially, objectively, a huge improvement. Now, chaps, I did a bit of it. I went on to Strava and looked at the data and compared those three rides just on the Paso de Llanda and looked at where he was quicker. And so he attacked 3.5 kilometers into the climb from the bottom of the climb. After 3.5 kilometers into the climb, he was already 54 seconds up on that 2021 time. So that was the bit where he still had teammates. It was, who was it at that point, Rob? You remember?
Well, it was Rafał Majka at the start, Jay Vine after that.
Jay Vine. So he was already almost a minute up on his 2021 performance, and he was 24 seconds up on his 23 performance. Then, obviously, when he attacked after 3.5 kilometres, Remco Evenepoel this year didn't even try to follow him, and that was where he opened up, well, another minute on the 2021 and not quite a minute on 2023. But I went back and watched those different climbs, and 2023 was pretty tactical, actually. Pogacar, at one point, there were various attacks going. He was sort of 10 wheels back and sort of ignoring the attacks at one point when Vlasov was going off the front, and then it would all come back together, and there was a moment of sort of when they would all sit up again. But notwithstanding everything I've just said, he does look like a different rider now. If you go back and look at 2023 and 2021, he looks leaner, he looks more mature, and he's clearly got faster and faster. Just to go back to what I was saying about the way the races are ridden, We talked last week about tactics, the tactics that other teams are employing, aren't employing. And we talked about how it was basically a question of how far can Pogacar's teammates take him at about sort of 41, 42 kilometers an hour, at which point he goes. Again, Robin, you'll be able to vouch for this because you commentated. I think you did the whole stage, or the whole stage was, sorry, the whole race was broadcast. It was, again, a very intense start of the race, so much so that, again, if you go into Strava and you look at the times on the Ghisallo and the Roncola, early climbs on the route on Saturday, they were as fast as they've ever been. The times set at the weekend, and that was in the peloton, behind the break, which we'll maybe talk about with Quinn Simmons. So, again, it was a very fast race. At the moment when Pogacar attacked, everyone was already tired. And there was no real, well, we saw what happened afterwards, big time gaps, huge time gaps, and riders coming in one by one. No chance to really organise any kind of chase behind him. And again, this method, we've seen it's now practised, perfected by Pogacar. This is how he wins by such a big margin.
But you also have to say his team was extremely strong and had everything locked down for quite a long period of time. There wasn't another team with similar numbers, and certainly they weren't vying for control on the front of that group. I mean, this more than anything was you know, he sort of catapulted into the position to make his move when he wanted to make it. But UAE Team Emirates, I mean, their show of strength. I mean, I said last week, we're not seeing that kind of, Team Sky style, Grand Tour style tactics in one day races very often. Well, on Saturday we did see that. They rode it like a Grand Tour mountain stage from, well, before the halfway mark, really.
I would suggest they had to do as well, because it was a really strong break of 14 riders up the road. Of course, Quinn Simmons was the biggest name there, wasn't he? He was an absolute animal on the bike at the weekend. Mm. Probably one of the best rides I've ever seen from him. In terms of how they rode it, I would suggest that they were given a little bit of a hand when they shouldn't have been by Red Bull Bora Hansgrohe.
I was going to ask what you chaps made of this, because again, on social media, there's a lot of criticism about this. I was hoping to hear from someone at Red Bull, actually, just to explain the tactics. I think it was Roger Hammond, and I forget who the second director sportif is. The backdrop to all this, which I also wanted to talk about, was Red Bull's disastrous monument season. Their best results in the monuments, 19th in Milan-San Remo, 11th in Flanders, 18th in Roubaix, 7th in Liège, 22nd in Lombardy. They had a stacked team at the weekend. Hindley, Roglic, Vlasov, and so on and so forth, Pellizzardi. They did help, chaps. They didn't have anyone in the break, and that's a big break, 14 riders. Does that excuse them contributing? Did it make any difference? Would it have made any difference if they'd held riders back?
Would it have made a difference to the final result? Perhaps not. However, you question helping UAE Team Emirates when they are so dominant. You know, for once, you've got a really big, strong break up the road, 14 riders. And we're not talking, you know, with all respect, I know Mattia Baez was there, but I'm not talking about five Bardianis and three Poltis. We're talking about mainly World Tour riders, big, big names who've won some massive races. And for once, there's an opportunity to make UAE work harder earlier on, so that in the latter stages of the race, there might be one or two riders less to help Pogacar do that crazy ascent of Passo di Ganda. Yes, it's still a long shot. I get that. And I know that Pogacar's victories at the minute do seem almost inevitable, don't they? Such as his dominance, as we've just talked about. But if you haven't managed to get a man in the break, then you've got all these amazing rises. Why would you then help Pogacar pull off what he's going to do? One thing I will say in Red Bull's defence is that it was a crash for Jai Hindley at the bottom of the penultimate climb. And of course, that clearly put him out. He was quite badly banged up, actually.
But Rob, the risk is, and you saw the sort of the watts that each of those individual Red Bull riders had available on the day. Mm. And where did Primoz Roglic finish? 22nd. He was the best. Did I just say that he was the best rider? So the risk is, if you don't contribute anything, and if you don't even believe in your chances, or demonstrate that you believe in your chances of going sort of toe-to-toe with Pogacar or Evenepoel, you know, another thing we often don't consider is that teams are riding for podium places, or they're riding for top fives. So if you don't contribute at all, and then you get to Passo di Ganda and you find out that your best rider is the 9th best rider on the Passo di Ganda, and or the 10th best rider, or the 15th best rider. And you've got a team like Red Bull with designs on becoming a super team. We've heard it, and we know that that's what their budget would suggest. They should be a super team. And they have been completely passive and completely invisible in the last monument of the year. As people might say, well, the alternative is attack with Roglic at kilometre zero when Simmons goes. Attack with Pellizzari. I didn't often, if we haven't seen the first few kilometres, we're going off what various websites sort of record of those, and they don't record necessarily every acceleration, every attack. Rob, I don't know if you can shed any light on what they were trying to do in that first sort of 30 kilometers of the race.
They weren't present in the attacks earlier on. And again, this is where I was commentating, obviously, with, you know, I'm there to ask the questions of the experts. I'm not the ex-rider, so I'll go off what they were telling me. And they were stunned. The people I was commentating with, they were absolutely stunned that they were contributing to helping UAE having not tried to get in the break. And as you say, you know, I mean, are you going to let Primoz Roglic or Jai Hindley up the road? Probably not. But again, it forces people to work harder. And I just think that now I'll say personally, it's got to such a stage with Pogacar that you have to gamble and try something new, don't you? Gamble and, you know, I mean, they didn't end up with that top five place, that podium place. Gamble, make them work harder. Just sit back, say, okay, then, you know, if you want to win it, you go and win it.
You know, because we know that the whole of Twitter would applaud in unison if Primoz Roglic attacked from the gun and was caught with 80 kilometres to go.
Yeah. I mean, sure, it's got to a stage where they shouldn't be bothering about what Twitter says.
That would
says.
Go down really well. Yeah. I think it's worth just lingering on Red Bull just for a moment, chaps, because obviously this was, well, the end of an era for Soudal Quickstep, and you could say the end of an era for Red Bull Bora Hansgrohe, because obviously Remco Evenepoel will be there next year. And as I've just said, it's been a pretty disastrous year for Red Bull, certainly in the monuments. You can quibble, they've won other things that on the stage racing front. It's not been quite so bad. But, you know, this is a team, as I said, they've got very, very big ambitions.
Daniel, you and I were sitting in the room, actually, at the end of last year, start of this year, when one of their big stated ambitions was to be a big classics team again.
Indeed. And after the Tour de France, which was probably, in some respects, one of the highlights of the year was Lipovic's performance at the Tour de France. But in the aftermath of that Tour de France, where obviously Roglic was kind of, well, he finished the Tour, but he disappointed. In the aftermath, we had the announcement of Remco's arrival in 2026. And also a lot of staff changes that were announced. Now, a lot of the DSs were going to change. So Bernie Eisel, we know, is leaving. Heinrich Hausler is leaving. Enrico Gasparotto is leaving. Rolf Aldag has already left. And we've got several new directors coming on board. Zach Dempster is going to be the chief of sports. Oliver Cookson is coming on board, head of racing from Ineos. Those two from Ineos. And other changes as well. Remco is bringing Klaus Ludovic from Soudal Quickstep. Sven van Torenhout, who at one stage looks as though he was going to be the Red Bull, the sort of chief of sports, that position that Zach Dempster is going to take. But van Torenhout is going to be a DS. Not coming, incidentally, is Kern Pelgrim, from who's been Remco's coach since he turned pro from Soudal Quickstep. And chaps, it occurs to me that this is the third year in a row where there are going to be big changes at Red Bull Bora Hansgrohe, because 2 years ago we had Roglic arriving. We heard that was going to be a new era. Last year there was another big reshuffle. New sort of nutrition staff came on board. Dan Bigham came on board. Johnny Whale. And all I've been hearing on the ground this year is that there's been a lot of transition. They're trying to change a lot of things, and that would explain maybe why the results haven't been slightly better. And now we've got another year of massive overhaul, and some of Roglic's statements, public statements, you can never read a whole lot into Roglic's statements, but they've been a bit oblique as well. Asked, you know, what's your future? We will see. And what we think we have grasped from Roglic is that he is seeking a bit of clarity from the team. And, you know, it's interesting. He went to Sierra Nevada to prepare for this, the last part of the season. And his results have been very underwhelming. I mean, 11th in the World Championship Road Race, 5th in Emilia, 13th in Trevalli Varesine, 22nd in Lombardy. Now, people could say, well, Roglic is clearly in the winter of his career, entering the winter of his career. He's clearly fading now. Another explanation could be that he's feeling a little bit demotivated and unsure about things as far as the team's concerned. So a bit of a crossroads for that team, I would suggest, chaps.
I mean, he's 36 in a couple of weeks' time. Now, I know in terms of sort of miles on the clock, kilometres on the clock, you know, he reached the world tour level relatively late. I think he was, well, certainly mid-20s, wasn't he? Maybe 25, 26 by the time he really made his impact at the top level. But at the end of the day, the, you know, the clock waits for no man, and he isn't going to be getting stronger and better really from this point, is he? It's going to be about, you know, getting the last results out of him that they possibly can. And I would suggest that all of the energy and focus will switch across to Remco Evenepoel. The difficulty there is deciding how and what they should be targeting, because, you know, Evenepoel, you know, at one end of the spectrum, there's a lot of expectation that he could challenge Tadej Pogacar at the Tour de France. Now, we've seen that. Whether or not he can or not, there is the expectation, is what I'm saying. Certainly from, you know, the Belgian media, there will be the expectation. We know he can win, you know, world titles, Liège-Bastogne-Liège, the toughest one-day races. It's going to require a bit of clarity with a new group of staff coming in to determine what it is they want to focus on in year one of Project Remco. And I would suggest that without wanting to sort of elbow Primoz Roglic off the stage, it doesn't make a whole lot of sense to put a lot of emphasis on what Roglic you know, might want to do. You know, he may still be able to contend for a Giro d'Italia or a Vuelta, but I would suggest that all of the energy is going to go towards Remco Evenepoel. He's their biggest, most expensive, most high-profile asset, and really the only one who can get into Tadej Pogacar's orbit. So a lot of work to do in a short space of time with a lot of new faces behind the scenes. People, you know, going to have to get on the same page very quickly, because let's face it, the orientation camps are going to be starting in a, you know, a matter of weeks, probably the next couple of weeks, aren't they?
The tour route will be obviously being filtered now to the teams. It's going to be announced in what, less than 10 days, a week? I mean, we're recording what, Tuesday the 14th, and then 9 days away, the tour route announcement. So that's coming soon as well. You'd imagine, we know that the Giro d'Italia is going to start in Bulgaria. You'd imagine that the Giro is already in conversations, as they always are, with riders saying, oh, come race here. And, you know, we've got this sponsor who might help you and blah, 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 blah. I even heard a rumour yesterday that Pogacar might be going back to the Giro, which would surprise me next year, given that if he's in the business of ticking things off, he should be thinking about the Vuelta a España in the next couple of years. And with Red Bull Bora Hansgrohe, it's not just Roglic. I mean, Jai Hindley, what does he do? He was pretty unlucky with crashes and injuries this year. When he has raced, he still looked good.
He rode a good Vuelta.
He did ride a very good Vuelta. And again, looked in good form at the start of the Giro before that crash out as well. Had prepared well to help Roglic. Lots of little decisions to be made. And another one, where is Oyer Lascano? Has not raced for a long, long time. There's a lot of question marks around a lot of what might happen.
Well.
Yeah, I mean, we'll not get into that, but we'll a lot of question marks about what might happen going forward to next year.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton, cycling podcast team car, the back of the pack, please.
That's Seb Piquet again to remind me to tell you that this episode is also sponsored by Babbel, which is a language learning app which can help you to learn a second or a third language quickly and relatively easily, because it's not necessarily a skill that comes to all of us as naturally as it does to my two co-hosts here, Daniel and Rob, both of whom are multilingual. I always feel at a bit of a disadvantage when I'm in their company, although I can more or less hold my own in English, or at least I hope I can. But I've been using Babbel to try and get to grips with Italian, and bit by bit, I am getting there. The Babbel app really breaks down the learning of another language into bite-sized lessons that can fit easily into your daily routine. And if you can do just 10 or 15 minutes a day, you begin to see real results quite quickly. Babbel can be tweaked to help you learn in the way that you respond to best. So by listening or speaking, reading or writing, and it keeps track of your progress and you pick up where you left off the last time. The language lessons are science-backed. They are designed by people who really understand how to teach languages, and you are learning real-life conversation right from the start. There's none of that kind of computer-generated phrases that don't mean anything. You'll be learning how to speak the language from day one, and before long, you'll be building your confidence, working on your pronunciation so you don't fall foul of the pronunciation police. Right now, all of our listeners can get up to 60% off a Babbel subscription. This is a limited time offer, but go to babbel.com/cycle and you can get 60% off at babbel.com/cycle. That's spelled babbel.com/cycle. Rules and restrictions apply.
Well, chaps, that nearly concludes our discussions about Il Lombardia, Giro di Lombardia, Tour of Lombardy. No bickering about boredom yet.
No, I think that might stay off, Mike. That maybe we could have a sort of after dark friend of the podcast special for people who don't have sensitive ears, who don't want to hear my nuanced take on what makes for compelling televised sport.
Gorgeous.
I mean, I'm not taking anything away from the achievements at all. Let's not get into it here. Should we just do a little wrap up?
Okay, but I would just mention the cheesecake of engagement again.
All it's a lot of cheesecakes this week. I'm getting hungry.
The cheesecake and all the reasons one watches professional cycling. And I put it to you that what's happening between Tadej Pogacar and Remco Evenepoel is one slice of the cake. There are the gorgeous autumnal views, the sepia-toned evening light, absolutely gorgeous. We talked earlier in the podcast about the relegation battle. Now, maybe that wasn't a big subject of conversation at Lombardy at the weekend, but that is something, that's where broadcasters need to help and we in the media need to help as well. There are so many things going on in any given bike race. And then if you focus on Pogacar against himself, against history, against, against the odds of repeating it again and again and again, there are lots of things to watch, lots of things to gorge on. But I get it. I've said it before, Lionel. It's personal preference. The other issue is suspicion as well. Some people are just suspicious about the whole thing.
In cycling, get out.
And that's legitimate. That's perfectly legitimate. And that can be a conduit. That can be a sort of tributary to boredom as well, or the unwillingness to watch, and I accept that.
Is this a roundabout way of saying that the most significant result of the Saturday's race was Ion Izaguirre's 13th place for Cofidis, vital points in the relegation battle? Well, Remco Evenepoel, of course, was second. Michael Storer, a very good third place for Tudor Pro Cycling, but at 3 minutes 14.
First ever Aussie on the podium.
Yeah, at Il Lombardia. Quinn Simmons, I mean, man of the day. I mean, it was an incredible ride. Brave, I mean, foolhardy, maybe. I mean, it was against all odds, probably, but just to be out there that long and cling on for fourth place. I mean, the time gaps tell the story, don't they? He was, what, three minutes clear over the Zambla Alta, wasn't he? And still, it did so well to hold that gap on the descent and then the valley road before the start of the final big climb.
I think that the clinging on was the most impressive thing. And actually, just to go back to the Red Bull tactics, if you really sort of squint, could it be that Red Bull were sort of fearful that the break was going to take away spots 2 and 3 on the podium? Did that justify them also riding?
Yeah, I mean, that was a fourth place. I mean, a 7-minute swing on the time in, what, the last 40K. But again, to still get fourth place just shows what was happening to the race behind, doesn't it? Isaac Del Toro, the Pogacar in waiting, the Mexican phenomenon, who was fresh off his 7th one-day race win in Italy this season when he won the Gran Piemonte. Is it the Gran Piemonte or Giro?
Gran Piemonte nowadays, but Giro del Piemonte originally.
Again, I mean, a sensational season for Del Toro. Lives in San Marino, I think, yes, Doesn't he? But Italy, clearly his second home. Lots of race wins there, and of course that fantastic Giro d'Italia. Tom Pidcock was 6th. and then he took a flight from Bergamo up to Maastricht for the UCI Gravel World Championships on the Sunday, quite a back-to-back, not quite Jacques Anquetil levels of Bordeaux-Paris to the Dauphiné, or which were, well, it's the other way around, wasn't it? But to do those two back-to-back races, we'll talk about the gravel in a moment. And Paul Seixas kind of backing up, confirming what we saw in Kigali, and then again in France in the Europeans, where he got that bronze medal last weekend. A very good seventh place for him. Another couple to mention, well, Adam Yates was 11th, and he then won the new one-day race, which finished on the Europa climb, which we know from the Giro d'Italia, Daniel, with the big, is it a church at the top? The
big dome on the, sanctuary, what do you call it?
Monastery.
Monastery, that's what you call it. Yeah, there was some beef there, a little bit of beef from, well, beef minus of Carpaccio from Christian Scaroni of Astana, because I'm just bringing up the results. Who was the UAE rider who took third? Was it Sivakov? It was Jay Vine, sorry. And Scaroni said to the Italian press he didn't see why UAE had to take third place, because he asked Jay Vine, can I have third? And Jay Vine told him where to stick it. I don't know, you might have told him quite politely. But anyway.
No sympathy there. I mean, okay. You know, yeah, they're UAE are hoovering up results left, right, and centre, but yeah,
it's an answer. I mean, they didn't even finish together in the end. Vine ended up putting 7 seconds into him. Incidentally, Lionel, that race that you're talking about was the sexily named first edition of the Trofeo Tessile e Moda, the Trophy of Textile and Fashion, Valdengo Europa. Biella, the town at the bottom of the Climb to Europa, is very famous for its textile industry, home to companies like Fila, you know, Fila, Bjorn Borg's clothing supplier for many, many years. The supplier of the pink jersey, the Giro d'Italia classic ones in 1998. They are from, and it's an acronym. I forget, I haven't got it up at the moment. Fila, F-I-L-A is an acronym. It's two brothers. Anyway, they're based in Biella.
That race, apparently, I mean, I'm not quite sure the history yet, but it's linked in some way to the old Trofeo Baracchi. I'm not sure how, because there's no two-up time trial.
Just in the spot in the calendar.
Right. I also noticed that it had taken the sort of hereditary results. It had taken on the results from... So if you looked on the results website at the previous winners of Tessile Moda, it was something like the 40-somethingth edition, and the last time it was held was Baracchi. So that's something for us to investigate, I think, in the off-season and probably ask some questions. It looked nothing like a Trofeo Baracchi.
Well, no, that was a two-up time trial, wasn't it?
Exactly.
Yeah, no. Bring back the two-up time trial. Break the boredom. Pair Tadej Pogacar with the last ranked rider on UAE and see how that goes. Let's have a sort of, some kind of system where we can sort of sandbag him a bit. I have to say the race in Slovenia the following day, the hill climb event where...
The charity event.
I mean, the fact that that's the big story of the cycling weekend. When you look on the kind of the sort of news aggregation websites, that Pogacar has been beaten by a 40-year-old amateur. I'm not sure that shows professional cycling in the greatest light. Not to take anything away from anybody's performance there, but it's a bit like Tiger Woods giving somebody a 10-shot advantage in a round of golf, and then the guy pulling out the round of his life and winning by a shot, and then all the headlines being, you know, amateur beats Tiger Woods. I mean, I don't know. I think the nuance has been lost a little bit in some of the coverage of the charity race. I mean, everyone's wincing here. Am I being a massive killjoy here?
You're such a litigious person, Lionel, that you're involved in all sorts of legal proceedings, and therefore your algorithm feeds you lawyer-related content. And it was a lawyer. Is that what's going on here? I made a mistake. I'm marching myself to corrections corner. Fila is not an acronym. No. They were a pair of brothers, the Fila brothers, who created that company in 1911.
Shall we move on to... We'll follow Tom Pidcock from Bergamo to Maastricht, where the UCI Gravel World Championships took place, a fourth edition. Now, it was going to be held in Nice, wasn't it? Which might have looked very different. Might have been a bit more telegenic, or perhaps just a bit more variety. This year's course... in that little southwestern corner of the Netherlands looked very much like last year's championships in Leuven, where I went last year to have a look at the gravel. There was a lot of kind of criticism last year and this, that really it's a sort of cycle path championships. It's not really capturing the spirit of certainly the sort of the US hardcore gravel. This is a sort of hybrid, more commercialized, perhaps a bit easier to broadcast, certainly a bit more digestible iteration of gravel racing. But I must say, I enjoyed both races over the weekend. The women's race was, I mean, there were 11 orange Dutch jerseys in each group, and quite an entertaining finish, wasn't it? Because Sharon Van Anroy was away. Lorena Wiebes and Marianne Vos had been up the road, but that's the wrong phrase for a gravel. They were off the beaten track or on the beaten track. But Van Anroy got away and she was in the finish straight and looked like she was going to get the gold medal and rainbow jersey, only for the Wiebes Vos group to catch her. And Lorena Wiebes won. And I think, Rob, you were saying she hasn't lost a bunch sprint for about 20 years now, I think. Talk about domination.
Oh, forever, yeah. I did the sum earlier in the year when she was winning sort of three or four, and she's just incredible on a completely different level. I mean, if Lorena Wiebes is in a bunch sprint, you're not winning.
And then the men's race. Did anyone catch any of this on Sunday?
I saw a bit of it. Just on the women and the Dutch. I mean, they're the gift that keeps on giving, aren't they, in terms of the sort of internal strife that follows everywhere. I mean, it does remind me a lot of, Lionel, well, both of you will certainly remember this, that the Dutch men's football team used to have this reputation for constantly sort of falling out and constantly being, well, sort of politics that affected matters on the field. And it seems to be the case with the women. The women's Dutch cycling team.
I think the thing is, with so many riders in the race for a start, because it was in their home country, I mean, they absolutely dominated the top 20. I think only, what was it? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Only 7, so 13 Dutch riders in the top 20. And yeah, I think it then comes down to, I mean, gravel racing supposed to be, it's not supposed to be a team sport anyway, really. It's supposed to be a race for individuals. So I think absolutely no problem with that. All race against one another. Silvia Persico of Italy was the rider that stood between a Dutch clean sweep of the podium in the women's race. And well, we mentioned politics and sport don't mix. Well, Florian Vermeers of Belgium, another win for UAE Team Emirates. He's one of the few riders who hasn't won a road race this year for UAE Team Emirates, but he more than made up for that with a rainbow jersey in the Gravel World Championships, albeit riding for Belgium. But keep politics out of sport. He's a local councillor still in Locristi, has been for a number of years, so politically engaged and a very good ride in the gravel, ahead of the Dutch rider Frits Bierstabos, and then Slovenia's Matej Mohoric, who's won this title before. He took the bronze medal. And Tom Pidcock's epic weekend out. He was sixth again. So sixth in Lombardy and then sixth on the gravel. He was going, of course, for a sort of hat trick of off-road world titles, having won the mountain bikes and the cyclocross before. And there was some comment about him from Kurt Bogerts, wasn't there, about how Tom Pidcock's desire is to kind of have a really broad palmarès of races on, you know, victories and excellent results across a range of different cycling disciplines. Well, he's certainly done that, but the gravel got away from him this year, maybe next year. But I think they're struggling to find hosts for it a little bit, aren't they?
I think it all comes down as well, and talking from sort of my background, it has to, you talked about it looking different to the US events and things like that. If it wants to be a big commercial success and a big thing, it has to be in this sort of commercial broadcastable format, because, you know, the sort of epic events must be absolutely incredible to take part in, be there at. But when they're lasting so long, when you've got one rider out in front and then, you know, it's on for so long, it's almost, because of the geographical area, the split between the riders, almost impossible to broadcast. They are not televisual spectacles, those races.
Yeah. Chaps, did you know that the cult of gravel is now contaminating running as well? As of about 6 months, you've got manufacturers bringing out gravel shoes, what were formerly known as trail shoes. Well, it's a sort of hybrid between a trail shoe and a road shoe. It's now called a gravel shoe.
I mean, the great irony, and this happened last year as well, is that the men's UCI Gravel World Championship race was on the same day as Paris Tour, which of course now has these gravel sections, has done since, I think, 2018. So it's long established now, going through the vineyards in the Loire Valley on its way down to Tour. They've also inserted a few interesting looking climbs. But again, the sort of the lack of joined up thinking in the race calendar, particularly at this end of the season, where they could reshape it so there was some kind of coherent narrative to, you know, could they have the road world championships and the gravel world championships, but keep the gravel away from the last major one day races of the season. It just feels like everything's all on top of one another. And I'm not having a go at the broadcaster here, but because of the timings, the gravel race overran a little bit, I think, and Paris Tour was up on schedule. So certainly on broadcast television, TNT, we didn't see an awful lot of Paris Tour at all. In fact, we just saw them kind of...
We just saw Decathlon make the biggest... Well, it wasn't just Decathlon, was it? In fact, you could argue it was Groupama who made the biggest cock-up. It was a curious finale where you had two riders away. Thibaut Gruel, who is from Tours or near Tours. Is he from the town itself? And Paul Lapéard, and then a break approaching from behind with a kilometre to go. But how far behind were they? They were a good, 200 metres or so, weren't they, with Stefan Bissiger of Decathlon, Albert Philipson of Little Trek.
Albert Witten.
And who else was in there, chance?
Christophe Laporte was and the winner was Matteo Trentin of Tour de Pro Cycling. Big win for them.
Big win. And they took the decision, the two up front, Cruel and Lapéard. Well, this was after Lapéard had stopped working, really. Cruel tried to call his bluff and said, well, neither of us are going to work then. Let's just wait for the other chaps to arrive. Slightly baffling. And both fast riders, probably Cruel, probably slightly faster on paper than Lapéard. But I don't know whether Lapéard thought that Stefan Bissiger's lead out was going to be decisive, and that was going to allow him to win the race, but it didn't happen. Matteo Trentin won for the third time, won Paris Tour.
Nice as well, because he'd won the old traditional route on a couple of occasions. This is the first time he won on the new route with the sort of vineyard, chemin and things like that, and the gravel sectors, whatever you want to call them.
Beautiful race, chaps. Another beautiful, make cycling pretty again. Well, it's already very pretty. But at this time of the year, and I sort of semi-facetiously said this to my followers on Twitter at the weekend, those who were sort of grousing about Lombardy being boring, I said, look, drink it in. You've got 3 months of velodromes and mud coming now. So enjoy these beautiful Paris Tour Lombardy with the leaves turning, the beautiful autumn light. There you go.
Just back to Lombardy and maybe sort of leaping forward into a few recent announcements of retirements. A little word for Rafał Majka, because, well, Tadej Pogacar paid his own tribute, his thanks, his sort of his gesture and sort of attempted handshake. I'm not sure whether they managed to quite shake hands, but he definitely gestured in Rafał Majka's direction, Pogacar, before he took off. Majka had done had been one of the UAE Team Emirates riders who'd done a full stint in support of Pogacar in what was his final race as a professional, retiring at the end of this year. And, well, I mean, he's won three stages of the Tour de France. He's won the polka dot jersey twice in the Tour de France. He won stages of the Vuelta. He won Tour Poland, I think, didn't he? Long time ago. His home race, of course, Polish rider. And I think he's been one of those kind of gritty Grand Tour riders who you could sort of never sort of shake off easily. And he transitioned quite happily into, you know, a real kind of loyal mountain domestique in the last few years for Tadej Pogacar. Other retirements, any others that have been announced in recent days?
There have been several. Arnaud Démare called it a day after Paris Tour. He was one of the most prominent, I would suggest, but Rob, there have been many more, haven't there? Peter Seri. Loyal lieutenant for Remco Evenepoel for many years, is not going to be moving with him to a Red Bull Bora Hansgrohe. He's giving up.
Louis Meintjes, he stopped as well in Lombardy, as did his teammate, the Italian Simone Pettilli. too. I think we'll probably get news of lots more this week as well as races finish, and especially with maybe the closure of one team and mergers of two other teams as well.
And Elia Viviani, la sua immensità, as Ciro calls him, his majesty, Elia Viviani, who of course has been riding for Lotto this year and was riding pretty well at the Vuelta a España. He told me at the Vuelta he was hoping to carry on, but I think faced with the paucity of options and there aren't many spots left on major teams for next year, I think he decided that it was probably wise to bow out. Now, should we bow out, chaps?
What, retire or just for this week?
That's always on the that's always on the table.
There's a large cheer in the distance there.
I can hear the cheers coming through the through the airwaves there. No fear, you're stuck with us, listeners, for a little while
for longer. A listener of the week. Should we bow out for a week at least, chaps?
Well, next week we will be reacting to the Tour de France route, which is, I think, being unveiled on Thursday the 23rd. So we will, well, we'll record sort of on the whistle, won't we? A little bit's leaked out. I kind of hate the fact that the Tour de France route is spoiled. I know too much about it already. It kind of spoils Christmas for me. That's my, I'd love to be able to watch the announcement and not know anything about it, not even know the identity of the start town. But we know it's starting in Barcelona. We assume it's finishing, well, we know it's finishing in Paris. We'll be battling to get off Alpe d'Huez, I suspect, potentially, maybe. Daniel?
Maybe.
If we're there?
Maybe.
If we're there.
Okay, well, that's next week. Until then, thank you very much, Rob.
Thank you.
And thank you, Ryan.
Thanks, chaps.
The Cycling Podcast was created in 2013 by Richard Moore, Daniel Freeb, and Lionel Burney.